change. One of these days.
Welcome, friends. This is Economic Update, a weekly program looking at the economic dimensions of our lives, our jobs, our incomes, our debts, what we pay, what we have to pay when we borrow money, all of it. I'm your host, Richard Wolff. I've been a professor of economics all my adult life. I've taught at several universities, and now I teach at the New School University in New York City. I also write regular columns for truthout.org, an independent source of analysis and news every day that I urge you to take a look at, truthout.org. We also maintain two websites for this program that we urge you to make use of. They're available to you 24/7 at no charge whatsoever. They contain material on all the topics we cover in this program. They also provide you with lectures, entire classes, everything you might want to know about economics from the kind of perspective that you're familiar with from this program. In addition, the two websites provide you with two other useful things. One, a way to communicate to us, to tell us what you like or don't like about the program, what kinds of questions you'd like us to address, and so on. Toward the end of every hour, I respond to a few of these questions that we select. Of course, please bear with us. We get many more questions than we have the time to respond to, so we have to be selective. And finally, what you can do on both websites is follow us. Click on the icon, and you can follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Pinterest. So here are the names and addresses of these two websites. The first is rdwolf.com. Very simple to remember, rdwolf.com. And the other one is democracyatwork.info. All one word, democracyatwork.info. Please make use of these websites, and that will be another way for us to keep in touch. I have an exciting guest today whom I will introduce in about 12 or 15 minutes, but we'll begin as usual with our shorter updates. The first is actually a group of updates on a topic that keeps coming up in your questions and comments to us and in the response I get as I travel around the country speaking. It has to do with health and the health system of the United States. One of the most interesting developments of the last few weeks has been the upsurge in medical companies, that is, companies that either make drugs or make medical appliances and so on, but particularly the drug companies, doing what's called in economics an inversion. And here's what that means. An American company buys a company in another country, merges with it, and in the process, moves its headquarters from wherever it was in the United States to the foreign country in which is located whatever enterprise they're buying. Why is this done? Very simple. For tax purposes. This enables an American drug company to get out of the tax obligations it has to Uncle Sam, and indeed the tax obligations it has to the states where it's located and to the cities and towns sometimes where it's located and so on. But mostly a way of escaping the federal income tax in the United States and going instead to be taxed in another country, so it's not surprising that the countries most looked after by American drug companies have been countries in which the tax rates are low. Ireland, for example, is a prime target. What does this mean? Well, it means that the United States government is deprived of billions, with a B, billions of dollars in tax revenue because these companies have cleverly shifted their tax obligations to another jurisdiction, to another country. Consider this statistic. So far this year, 2014, companies worth $400 billion have made efforts to leave the United States by means of these inversions. Medtronic is the most recent company, a very large company. AbbVie, a large drug company in Chicago, is trying to buy Shire Corporation in Ireland even as we speak. So this is a serious problem for all of us, because it means the taxes not going to the federal government mean one of two things. Either the federal government will have to tax the rest of us to make up for the revenue that these drug companies are escaping. And let me remind you, these are drug companies that were born and grew in the United States, that many times got all kinds of federal and state subsidies and supports and encouragements. They are a product of the United States as a whole. They're just escaping their tax obligation as the reward for what has been done for them. So either the federal government cuts back on services because it's not getting the money from those escaping drug companies, or it goes to the rest of us to make up in extra taxes what's not being given by very large and very profitable drug companies. So what has this produced? Well, it's encouraging to note that there are some federal officials, some members of Congress and the Senate, who are concerned about this and are beginning to introduce legislation. But whatever good feeling you might get from that is immediately destroyed when you realize what it is they propose to do. Their plan, I am not making this up, their plan is to prevent or to keep drug companies from continuing to leave the United States and depriving the federal government of taxes by, get ready, lowering the taxes on corporations here in the United States, because then there'll be less incentive for them to leave. You don't need rocket science to understand that if that's your solution, you're still left with the basic problem that less tax money is coming into Washington from big, rich drug companies than there used to be, and than they ought to pay. So this is not a very good solution at all. Elsewhere in the health field, there was a story in the Wall Street Journal, dated June 20th of this year, that talks about the increases in insurance rates, medical insurance rates, planned by the medical insurance companies between 2014 and 2015. I was alarmed to learn that the projected increases go from 8.5% in 1 year all the way up to, ready, 22.8% over the next year. I then learned from the same article in the Wall Street Journal, an article written by Louise Radnofsky on June 20th, that between 2008 and 2010, the cost of medical insurance, not through your employer, but if you have to buy it yourself, went up more than 10% a year. And we're talking about staggering increases in the cost of medical care before and since Obamacare went into effect, leading anyone who's aware of these to understand that whatever the virtues of Obamacare may be, in particularly in bringing uninsured people into the world of medical insurance, one thing it didn't do was to lower the cost. In fact, it's clearly stimulated even wilder cost increases for medical insurance than we had before. It's a medical reform that left intact all the forces making medical care a major drag on the standard of living of the American people. The next item, kind of a sad item, but one I thought was worth talking about, was the death last week of a famous doctor named Arnold Relman, R-E-L-M-A-N. He was, for many, many years, the editor of the New England Journal of Medicine, one of the most respected journals of medicine in the world. And what was striking about him in his life was a statement he made a long time ago, 1980s, in which he wrote, I won't quote it to you, but if you're interested, there were good obituaries for Dr. Arnold Relman all last week. He predicted in 1980 that if we didn't do something as a nation to control the delivery of medicine, to control the pricing of medical care, that the United States was at risk of becoming the outlier, the worst performing advanced industrial nation when it came to the relationship between the quality of care we deliver to our people and what we charge them for it. The reason I bring up his passing and the fact that he said this 30-odd years ago was my final update for today about health, which has to do with the report by the Commonwealth Fund. The Commonwealth Fund is perhaps the most prestigious medical research foundation in the United States. It's 100 years old, was founded by very wealthy philanthropist, the Harkness family of New England, and it just released a report, which you can get by going to commonwealthfund.org, and there you will see the results. The United States there places dead last in the 11 most developed industrial countries in the world. It's absolutely extraordinary. One of the most interesting results of this, besides the abysmal position of the United States, on the one hand, what it costs to get medical care in the United States, and on the other hand, what kind of medical care you actually get and with what medical results. But I found equally interesting, and I'll give you the numbers in a moment, the fact that the socialized medical system of Great Britain, the NHS as it's called there, the National Health Service, came in first, that it was found by this American foundation to be overall the best system of medical care in terms of what it cost and what it delivered in the quality of medical life and medical health of its people. Here are the results. The United States comes in last, Britain comes in first, and countries like Germany and Netherlands and so on are in the, and France are in the middle. Here's what struck me. Healthcare costs in Britain, it's counted in pounds because that's their currency, £2,008 per head is the cost of delivering medical care to the British population. In the United States, £5,017. That's well more than twice the cost. So we're number 11 in the quality of the care and in the medical condition of our people. But we're way number one in the cost. We outrun everybody else in the cost. What Dr. Relman feared in the 1980s has indeed come to pass. He was a wise editor of the New England Journal of Medicine, but he was also an extraordinarily perceptive predictor of what we have. If you are interested, you can read a very good story about the Commonwealth Fund report by reading the British newspaper The Guardian, dated June 17th. My next update, moving along quickly, has to do with the recent senatorial election, primary election in Mississippi. The incumbent, Thad Cochran, won re-election. I'm not so much interested in that as I am interested in understanding what was at stake in this election. Mr. Cochran made use and appealed to African Americans, who are a huge part of the population in Mississippi, to help him win the election. He was contested by a Mr. McDaniel, a Tea Party favorite, and they struggled over what was happening in Mississippi. And I think there is an important issue. Mississippi ranks, as everyone knows, I think, who pays attention, among the poorest states in the United States, the lowest levels of education, highest levels of obesity, and perhaps you don't know, but one of the highest in the percentage of reliance on the federal government. That is, Mississippi has a larger portion of the money it spends by the state government in Mississippi that comes from the federal government, much larger than most other states in the United States. It was a state, therefore, that is in trouble and depends on the federal government for an inordinate portion of what it provides to its people. Consider then the strangeness that the debate between Cochran and McDaniel that decided the election was the debate in which Mr. McDaniel, who did surprisingly well, argued about the awful federal government and the need for Mississippians to free themselves from an oppressive federal government. Now, in a state that is dependent more than most on the federal government, where everything from schools to police services to hospitals get federal money more than most states, it's kind of extraordinary to make the federal government the problem. But it's a sign of how America works. The economic problems we have, and Mississippi has more than its share, we turn to the government to solve them. But we try to convince our people that the problem is the government. To not ask, why are we getting low wages and are we so poor? Why do we not have enough jobs? Why is our economy in such trouble? Instead of asking the business community that shapes our economy more than anything else to account for its failures in the state, we have a political system that focuses everybody's attention on the state, on politics, as if the problem were politics and not economics, as if the problem were politicians rather than the businesses who decide whether or not there'll be jobs in Mississippi, whether or not they will hire people in Mississippi, whether or not they will pay them living wages, and so on. Something to think about. An economic system that abuses people and then gets them to be angry, not at the business community that shapes the economy, but at the politicians. Very interesting system. Very good for business, but not so good for anybody else. Final short update. I don't want to eat too far into our guest and the interview. I do have to respond briefly to an op-ed that appeared on June 22nd in the New York Times. It was written by a Harvard professor of economics, Gregory Mankiw, by name. In this article, Mankiw did what he often does in his public writing and what the New York Times seems to favor. He explained why the extremes of wealth and poverty were fine. He indeed knocked on Thomas Piketty, who has gotten a lot of attention recently because of his book about capital in the 21st century, where he shows how capitalism produces inequality and always has. But Mankiw will have none of it. Wealth and poverty are good, he says. Even better, and this is what the article he writes is devoted to, we should not have any laws prohibiting or limiting the wealth that really rich people can leave to their children or anyone else. In other words, we shouldn't have inheritance taxes. Mr. Mankiw, if nothing else, is consistent. But here's his argument. Wealthy people who are allowed to leave their wealth to their kids will therefore save a lot while they are rich and living their lives. Why? Because they're wanting to give much to their children, and they're not troubled by laws that prevent it, especially not if Mr. Mankiw had his way. And why is this good? Well, you see, Mr. Mankiw explains to us, a little bit like we were children, the wealthy person who can leave money to his or her kids will save a lot. And when he or she saves a lot, they may choose to invest that money that they've saved. And if they invest the money, it may create jobs. And if they create jobs, that's all good for the rest of us. And so, and he literally ends the article this way. We all should be, you ready? Grateful to wealthy people who can leave all their wealth to their kids because if they invest it and save it in a certain way, we'll get jobs. Let me respond briefly. This argument would make exactly the same sense if we spoke about persons who stole a lot of money. Let's think of your average person with an average income. He or she decides to become a thief, steals from all of us a whole lot of money, and becomes very wealthy, and wants to leave it to their children. How nice. And so they take the money they stole and they save it and maybe they'll invest it and then maybe we'll get jobs. If that were to happen, if they saved their money and invested it and got jobs, should we celebrate stealing? Or is there a problem here? There's so many problems, I don't know where to begin. Number one, if a wealthy person decides to save money to leave it to their children, that doesn't mean they're going to invest the money. They may use that money, for example, to lend to a government. Many wealthy people do. They may use that money to make all kinds of risky speculations that don't pan out and plunge economies into crisis. We're living through that one right now. And finally, even if they were to decide, which they're free not to, to take the money they save, their wealth, and invest it, they might choose, as most of them are, to do that in another country, meaning for Americans, no benefit at all. In fact, loss of jobs. So there's a lot of ifs between giving someone wealth and having a benefit for the rest of us. But here's the better argument. What do we need to have some people wealthy for? There's no need. We could all have equal incomes or minor variations, and then we could decide democratically that we'll take a portion of our roughly comparable incomes and put it aside as a fund for investing and creating jobs that way. That way we would all be creating jobs, as many or more. We would actually use the money for the purpose we wanted, which is job creation, rather than giving it to a few wealthy people who may or may not decide to do any one of a bunch of things but do not guarantee at all any benefit to us. And in all of it, Mr. Mankiw never even gives a moment's attention to an old American ideal. That was, we don't want rich people to be wildly wealthy and leave huge amounts to their children. We would like rather that everybody starts roughly in the same situation. We would like it rather that there's a level playing field. We don't want some people to have wild advantages denied to others, even though others are in no way to blame for that. We don't choose who we're born to, as you may remember. None of that worries Mr. Mankiw. He's an enthusiastic Harvard professor for inequality and no tax on inheritance. Amazing that he believes it. Amazing that he admits it, and amazing that the New York Times thinks that's the best they can do for op-ed in economics. All right, so much for that. Let me turn now and welcome Victor Wallace to our program. I'm very pleased and indeed honored that I have Victor here with me today. Let me introduce him to you. Victor Wallace is the managing editor of Socialism and Democracy, an important journal that's been around how long, Victor?
Well, 28 years now.
28 years of annual publication. Mm-hmm. Victor Wallace taught political science for many years at Indiana University in Indianapolis, and more recently at the Berklee College of Music in Boston, Massachusetts. His writing and editing have encompassed a wide range of popular and revolutionary movements. He has been corresponding with prisoners and active in prison support efforts for over four decades. And he is currently working on a special issue of Socialism and Democracy, focusing on, I quote, mass incarceration and political repression. And he's working there with guest editors Mumia Abu-Jamal and Johanna Fernandez. So welcome very much, Victor, to a conversation. What we're going to be talking about today, let me introduce, is the extraordinary phenomena of mass incarceration in the United States. For those of you that are not familiar with this, the United States literally falls off the chart when you compare nations as to what proportion of the people in that country are imprisoned, are made to spend years and years of their lives behind bars. But it's also interesting, and I want to bring this to your attention, that the National Research Council, that's part of the government-maintained academies of science in this country, been around a long time, commissioned a major report that was released in April of this year, a 464-page report by the National Research Council. And there was an excellent story about it, if you're interested in looking at it, in the Washington Post on April 30th. What they point out is also that for most of the history of the United States, we had the following statistic for the number of people in jail. Hovered around 100 people per 100,000 American citizens. At least back as far as the 1920s, that was stable. It was around that number in the 20s, the 30s, the 40s, the 50s, and the 60s. Something happened in the middle of the 1970s, and we suddenly departed from our own history and put quantities of people in jail like there was no tomorrow. Let me just give you the basic statistic. Between the mid-70s and today, the number of people in jail per 100,000 Americans went from that average of 100 over the last half century, before the 1970s, up to, you ready, 700 per 100,000. A sevenfold increase over the traditional norm. Something is extraordinary in the United States, and what I want to talk about with Victor Wallace is the whys, the wherefores, the meanings, and the implications. So let's start, Victor. Mm-hmm. Tell us as best you can, before we take our mid-program break, why? Why do you think We put those so many people in jail relative to our population. Why did it explode after the 1970s? What's going on?
Mm. Yeah, I mean, everything comes together in a way, and it's a real segue from what you were talking about earlier, because the criminality of the establishment, including both the private and the government sectors, is involved in this. I think this whole expansion of the prison population coincides with the period of financialization of the economy that you've talked about. It also coincides more directly with the cutting back of welfare, you know, the whole right-wing reaction that took place in the 1970s, and all that had previously been spent on welfare going instead into funding the incarceration. And more specifically, it was the drug war was the technique. But I think what really started the whole thing going in a political sense is also the fact that there had been a terrific liberation movement on the part especially of African Americans, who of course are a disproportionate percentage of the prison population, resulting in the final legal victory over formal segregation in the South, the legal establishment of the right to vote for everybody irrespective of race and so on. So now, comparable to the period right after the formal abolition of slavery, there was a drive to kind of find some functional equivalent of that kind of repression to control the population. I mean, in other words, the population that had to be controlled was, of course, those who didn't have a place in the economy, who didn't get the kind of investments that you were talking about, and they have to be warehoused some way. And they can no longer be kept under control through the traditional segregation laws. So now the new method is criminalization. And that's what the drug war is all about. And that's what, of course, this fairly well-known book now, The New Jim Crow by Michelle Alexander, is pertinent to that, because she describes in great detail the whole process. So I think just in brief, that gives a sense of it.
Let me remind our audience that the population in our jails, which exceeds 2 million people, is overwhelmingly male and overwhelmingly, relative to its proportion of the population, African-American, Hispanic, and other ethnic groups. So there is a bizarre kind of transition that you're pointing to, Victor. To make something very complicated simple, you stop helping people through economic supports of all kinds, from welfare to Head Start programs and everything else, and you move the money into prisons, which are very, very expensive to house a human being for a year in a prison with all of that goes with that. So you're not saving any money. You're not developing people, since it's crystal clear from anyone who knows anything about our prisons that they basically function to make whatever the problem an individual has worse by the time he comes out of that situation. Mm-hmm. It's hard to understand how a society would want to make the very transition you describe. How do you help us understand? Why does, again, I'm repeating myself, why?
Yeah.
Expand on what you're saying.
It's the politics associated with the right-wing reaction in the 1970s, that began in the 1970s and culminated with the election of Ronald Reagan in 1980, and the appeal to a kind of backward-looking segment of the white population, which is served very well by this system, because one of the characteristics of the prison system, the way it's set up, is that it's like an employment creator for people in remote rural areas of the state, and it accomplishes several purposes by that setup, because most of the people who are incarcerated are from the major cities of the respective states, and yet they're sent at great distances from where they live. Their population is counted in the population of the districts in which the prisons are located, rather than in the districts that they come from. So this has implications in terms of
government programs,
government programs, and so on. And
if I may say, if I'm not mistaken, by moving then urban people to the rural, you get the rural areas to get more services than they otherwise would. Mm-hmm. But you don't allow most of those prisoners to vote, so they can't actually participate.
Right, exactly.
So they're being used in multiple ways by the prison system.
Right, exactly. And the distance between the prison population and their home communities is also an important factor in itself. It's a kind of breakup of their communities. So this whole process of criminalization, including the drug war, was a way of breaking up any possible resistance of the kind that was developing with the liberation movements of various kinds that were forming in the first out of the civil rights movement, the black liberation movement in a broader sense. So it was a whole reaction against this, which was initially in the form of direct repression, like the FBI's campaign against the Black Panther Party, the assassination of Fred Hampton and others, and so now a more systemic approach to undercutting the communities out of which those movements emerged by getting them sunk into the drug economy and then using that as a pretext for control, and with the result of having this mass incarceration.
Okay, we're at the halfway point in our program. I'm going to take a very short break, and then we're going to come back to Victor Wallace, and I'm going to pick up by asking him to talk a little bit more about this broader political dimension of what would otherwise be seen more narrowly in terms of crime and punishment and all of that. So please stay with us. This is Richard Wolff. This is Economic Update. We will be back in a very few number of seconds. Welcome back, friends. This is Economic Update. I'm your host, Richard Wolff. I want to remind you again of the two websites that we maintain where you can find out more, communicate with us, and also follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Pinterest. rdwolff with two Fs .com and democracyatwork.info. Before the break, I was talking with our guest, Victor Wallace, editor of the journal Socialism and Democracy, and increasingly an expert on prisons and incarceration. So I want to go back and ask you to amplify a little bit more. The period of the 1960s was a period of upheaval in the United States. Mm-hmm. It was a major movement by African Americans to begin to be part of American society in all the ways that they had been excluded before, and it was a more general criticism of the economic system. Mm-hmm. It frightened traditionalist and conservative Americans. Do you see the explosion of incarceration, of imprisonment, as a consequence of that period? Tell us a little bit more about the political side of this.
Yeah, it's definitely a process of keeping control. And I think what also needs to be added, it's not just a question of putting people in prison. This is something which Michelle Alexander explains very well in her book. It's the whole criminalization, including even if you don't go to prison, you may be sort of on the police radar for various things. And one of the most striking things is how the kinds of problem that are encountered just by poor people, as a matter of fact, can lead to criminalization. In fact, just in this recent issue of The New Yorker, June 23rd, there was an amazing article about this Judicial Correction Service, so-called. I don't know if you saw it.
No.
It's about how someone who, for example, doesn't falls behind in paying traffic tickets or something like that, gets put on probation and then put into the custody of these judicial correction services. They're not in prison, but they're tracked. And they themselves have to pay the cost of their being tracked under the threat that if they don't keep up with their costs, they can be put in jail. So, and then another type of thing that's similar to that, which has been reported especially in California, is the police will use the pretext of stopping someone for jaywalking to then criminalize. They'll put handcuffs on them without any explanation, or if there's any kind of resistance, they'll even shoot them in some cases and kill them. So there's a whole, this kind of practice keeps a whole community under control. The other thing along similar lines, and this gets into the question of who's a political prisoner and who isn't, because political imprisonment is a major aspect of it. And it's, of course, those who were originally politically active and who were imprisoned on charges connected with their political activity, like the Black Panthers, have been imprisoned for decades now. But in addition to that, there are people who, as a result of their experiences, become politically aware while they're in prison, not only become aware, but they start organizing, they become whistleblowers in the prison, and they are subjected to extra punishment. And that there's such a culture now within the prison industry of imposing extra punishment. It's considered not to be enough to confine someone, that you have to deprive them of every possible sensory stimulation and deprive them of medical care when necessary and so on. And then the other thing is, part of this also, the private sector gets into the process as well, just as they did in this judicial correction service, which is a private enterprise. Some of these, the population of private prisons has increased even faster than the general prison population, especially among incarcerating immigrants. And of course, they have a terrific interest in maintaining a high prison population, and also in passing off the costs onto the prisoners themselves. So increasingly, people are caught in a bind. They're subjected to surplus punishment, you might say. It's not enough to lock you up. You have to be sort of stripped of every conceivable right.
It occurred to me also that when we explore the economic dimensions of this, mm-hmm. Because I've dealt with this on the program in the past, there's a growing number of prisoners that are used as workers, that are mm-hmm. literally rented out yep. by the prisons yep. to private employers mm-hmm. at ridiculously low payment because yep. of their quasi-slave status in this right. way. That has an effect because it lowers wages in an area or a region, because the regular non-imprisoned worker is effectively forced to compete with much lower payment for right. that. So it has that kind of effect that really is extraordinary. And if you look at the numbers, suppose you take the general number that I see used in economic discussions, that we have 2.5 million people in the jails. Those are 2.5 million people that ought to be counted as unemployed, since the mm-hmm. vast majority yeah. of them are unemployed. Mm-hmm. And that means we ought to adjust the official unemployment numbers, which do not count yeah. prisoners, yeah. to add them.
Right.
Well, for example, right now we have roughly 11.5 million people counted as unemployed who are not prisoners, mm-hmm. And that gets us your 6.3% that the newspapers are full of. Mm-hmm. But if you added the 2.5 million people who are in fact unemployed because mm-hmm. we put them in jail, yeah. then the unemployment rate would jump mm-hmm. a considerable amount above 6.3% and be a more accurate feature. And you have to kind of wonder how a society like ours could handle 2.5 more million people suffering unemployment. What kind of change in the level of militancy and demand for economic change would you get if you had that many more people forcing the rest of us to confront the inequalities and the injustices of an economic system that can't provide a decent job for that many people? So it is another way, I guess, of your saying to us that there are all kinds of larger economic and political economy implications of
Absolutely.
Jail.
Yeah, and that's, in fact, one of the reasons why they have to be, from the standpoint of the system, why they have to be kept in prison. And also, I should add to that for the people who are subjected to this, when they come out of prison, it's so difficult to get a job as well. There are so many obstacles to it, and so it's very hard to make a life for oneself afterwards. So, and I would add in terms of the figures on unemployment, what do you say about the military? And this gets us back to the crimes of state, you might say, because the crimes of the state and of the establishment include not only the type of economic things like you talked about earlier in the program, but just the sending drones over the country, killing innocent people, and so on. All this, there's such an atmosphere and a culture of violence and criminality it's, in a sense, one has to look at any kind of definition of crime used to incarcerate people within that context, and that so many of the people who are caught up in the so-called criminal justice system are not at all of a criminal mentality, but have been either forced into sort of petty crimes of one kind or another, or have been criminalized for things that are not crimes at all, just for asserting their dignity. And when a police officer stops them for something like jaywalking or something like that.
Well, you know, again, let me push you on something you've partially answered, but I keep thinking it is so bizarre, the statistic that we are, for decade after decade, even through the Great Depression, a population, you know, in the Great Depression, we didn't have jobs for people on a scale worse than today, but we didn't do that. Mm-hmm. We kept the number of people in jail at roughly 100 persons per 100,000 population. Mm-hmm. But then in the 1970s, it goes nuts, mm-hmm. and we have maintained a crazy 700 people per 100,000. We didn't all suddenly become more criminal than we had been before as a people. There's no reason to think that way. Yeah. So obviously something changed to put all those people in jail, and there's really no explanation from the system.
Yeah.
I mean, your explanation uses economics and politics and makes logical sense.
Yeah.
But what alternative explanation would there be?
Well, it's a question of just getting down to the more immediate things, and that's where the war on drugs comes in, because the war on drugs creates crimes where they didn't exist before. The possession of something or other, and then not only creates the crime, but also establishes these horrendously long sentences. So if you create a new crime, you establish a horrendously long sentence, and then that's what directly fuels the this.
So
this
you might say then that over the years that African American, particularly, and Hispanic and poor whites as well, lived in an economic system that gave them few benefits and lots of grief. Mm. Many of them found their way to drugs that were purveyed in these communities as a partial way to cope with life. Mm-hmm. Then suddenly in the 1970s, this situation, itself a kind of accommodation to the system, allowed there to be a basis to move all these people out of their communities and out of their lives and into jails, which was felt for some other reasons to be necessary at that time. That's your argument. Mm-hmm. The drug situation was simply the pretext.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the drug situation is the pretext, and it came really in as in response to the fear of political organizing that would otherwise take place in these communities. You had to break up the community. So the drug commerce, drug taking itself helps to demobilize people, but then it also provides a pretext for a greater police presence, greater control, and then the control extends itself into the prison system, and then within the prison system into surplus punishment meted out against those who are active in trying to resist its effects.
Your argument leads me to a question. We all know that in a number of states there's been a legalization at least of marijuana, mm-hmm. both possession and use, and there's been a relaxing of prosecutions for that. Does that suggest that there's a shift going on now? Is there something happening, whether it be the amount of money that has to be spent on prisons in a system that solves its problems this way? Or do you think this is changing, the situation that you have analyzed and described for us?
Well, I think there's beginning to be an awareness of this, as symbolized by that book of Michelle Alexander, and I think some of the decriminalization of marijuana and so on is part of the reaction against this. There needs to be much, much more of that type of reaction. I mean, there's even a sort of a token recognition by the federal government that too many people are in prison, but it hasn't gone down to the level of the local police and enforcement. The culture of controlling the culture and the political necessity of controlling the communities hasn't changed, and so that's much harder to bring about. and there has to be, and there are movements of people within the prison. There's a terrific political education going on in the prisons, and all this is fueling greater awareness on the part of people about this problem. And I think especially the communities that the prisoners come out of need to be aware of this. They're becoming more aware of this. So there is some kind of resistance, but so far it hasn't been enough to really change the big situation.
I'm struck also that you talked earlier about a continuum, that it's not just the question of the people literally sitting behind bars in a prison
or
a jail, but it's the probation system that they are forced into. But I can think now of more and more, based on what you've so interestingly told us. The stop and frisk movement, for example, the opposition, rather, to it, that was very strong here in New York as well as in other areas. Well, stop and frisk is another control mechanism.
Sure. Yeah.
Having the police be overly present in the community, to be rough with people in the community, to stop people much more readily if they're African American or Hispanic or whatever. These are all then parts of a system, only one portion of which is the actual prison.
Yeah.
And then if you then increase all the numbers that are affected, now you're talking about impacting a major part of our society.
And of course the disenfranchisement of former felons, which is 6 million is estimated, of number of people who can't vote simply because they've previously served a prison sentence. It makes a huge difference.
Very interesting, because we used to say about people who had been imprisoned, they've quote-unquote paid their debt to society for the crime they committed, and therefore they oughtn't to be made to suffer if they've paid the debt. It's like saying you've paid the debt, but you got to pay some more in the form of not voting or having a hard time getting a job.
Yeah.
When is this special issue of socialism and democracy that deals with all these questions coming out, so that interested listeners might look for it?
It's scheduled for publication in November, and you can keep track by going to our website, Socialism and Democracy, SDOnline, one word, .org. And yes, look us up.
Victor, thank you very, very much for joining me, and I hope all of you think about the economics and the politics of incarceration, because they play such a large role both in our history and in our situation today. Thank you again, Victor, very much for coming. In the remaining time that we have in our program today, I'm going to be dealing with some of the questions you sent in. One question was, would I update everyone on the gender wage gap? In other words, what does the latest research show on the relationship between the incomes of women and men in the United States? Have we achieved what several laws passed back in the 20th century committed the United States to, which is wage parity? That is, that women and men should be paid the same for comparable work. It used to even be called the comparable worth struggle. Well, I have in front of me an answer to that. The latest research from the Institute for Women's Policy Research in Washington, D.C. The director of that, Heidi Hartman, a person who went to graduate school with me many years ago, is the leader and has been for a long time. And they produced a research fact sheet dated April 2014 called The Gender Wage Gap by Occupation. And so here's the bottom line for those of you that asked. During 2013, the last year for which total data were available, median weekly earnings for female full-time workers. Median means 50% of women had more than this, 50% had less. So it's a kind of general measure. The median weekly income for a full-time female worker in America was $706. For men, a median weekly full-time engaged employed man earned $860 in a week. And that means women earned 82.1% of what men earned. In other words, nothing remotely like parity. It may be better than what it was in the 50s and 60s, but the notion that we have come to a situation where women and men earn comparable income for comparable work has not been achieved, is not being achieved in the United States, and that is the answer to your question. Second question comes from Great Britain. Thank you very much for sending it in. But the answer to this question, I think, affects everybody. So that's why I chose this one. Recent statistics show that house prices in Great Britain, and even more in London, are taking off again. They're rising at a clip in London of 20% per year increase in housing prices, and in England as a whole, not far below 10%. These are levels that were first seen in 2007 and 8, just before the crash of our economy, and then they were seen again in 2010, because in England, the crash resulted in another boom up and then another crash. So here we are, the third time peaking at these crazy numbers. What is going on? Well, the answer to this is not that the British people are unusual in how they behave. Similar patterns are evidenced elsewhere. What's going on here is an economic dimension of modern capitalism. If you produce extreme inequality of wealth, and the British are doing that, like the Americans are doing that, and many others, you're creating huge pools of wealth in relatively few hands. And because of that, the mass of people do not have the wealth they once had because it's been concentrated in a few people's hands. That means the average person is able to buy less in the way of goods and services than he or she used to be able to. And that means for the wealthy, there's not much incentive to take their extraordinary wealth and invest it in producing goods and services, and therefore creating the jobs they want so much credit for. And the reason they're not doing it is not because they're mean-spirited, but the mass of people don't have the buying power. So there's no point in taking your wealth and investing it in production because you can't sell the product. So what do the wealthy do if they don't invest their wealth in job-creating production? Well, one of the things they do is speculate in real estate. They start buying each other's homes and bidding up the price. They all enjoy this because they're becoming more and more wealthy as the value of their homes goes up. But it's a kind of frenzy that pretty soon gets to levels of housing that collapse because nobody can afford it anymore. That's been the history of Britain. They had a collapse in 2008. They had another collapse in 2010. And they're now so worried that Mark Carney, the governor of the Bank of England, is saying publicly, we're facing another risk of catastrophe. My point, if you leave a capitalist system to work its normal ways, to concentrate wealth in relatively few hands, as Thomas Piketty's book shows us, and as we've discussed on this program, one of the results is the periodic real estate boom that becomes a real estate bubble, that becomes a real estate bust, spreading its disaster all over the economy. Remember, we've plunged into our crisis in the United States, starting with the subprime mortgage disaster. That's when the cost of housing and the borrowing that built it up was no longer sustainable. This is a system problem. It's not going to be resolved by this or that change in interest rates or anything else. Next, one of you asked me to talk again about the wealthiest in the world. I do get quite a few comments from all of you that I appreciate about those that are the wealthiest amongst us, and I can understand the fascination, but I'm going to try to develop a perspective on that that you might not be used to. I have in the past used work by the Capgemini private investment outfit. They used to work together with Merrill Lynch. They now work with RBC Wealth Management. In any case, they produced together, Capgemini and RBC Wealth, a World Wealth Report every year. And I looked recently at the World Wealth Report for 2014. Here's what I found, that the really wealthy, the ultra-rich, and by the way, ultra-rich are all the people who have at least $30 million or more in what's called investable wealth. So they don't count whether you have a house or two or six. They don't count whether you own art. This is a question of what's in your bank account, what's in your stock portfolio. So if you have more than $30 million, you're counted as the ultra-rich. So here's the facts that you asked me for. First, in the world, as of the end of 2013, there were 128,000 ultra-wealthy people. That's all. We have a population in the world of several billions, and 128,000 are ultra-rich. Together, they hold assets worth $18 trillion. That's more than the total output of goods and services in the United States this year. They average 140 million each, these 128,000 people, okay? But now here's what I want to stress to you. During 2013, the average wealth of these ultra-rich people rose by 12%. Most of you listening to me did not have your wealth rise by 12% last year. You'd be lucky if it rose at all. But those people's ultra-net worth, as they put it, rose 12%. But here's the interesting thing. It rose the most in Asia, 19.8%. The United States, North America, with Canada, came in at 19.4%. But here was what's most interesting to me. Latin America, the ultra-rich only rose by 1.7%. Guess what? Over the last 10 years, Latin American governments, more than governments anywhere else, have been captured by popular forces, by radicals, by socialists, by critics of capitalism and critics of what capitalism did to their country. And here's an interesting effect. The rich who are still there were not able to expand at the expense of everybody else the way they did in Asia and North America. That's all we have time for today. This is Richard Wolff, signing off for Economic Update and hoping that you will join me again next week.
Your time now, babe. But after a while, it's gonna be my time, babe. They ain't gonna change. Change, change, change. Change, change, change.